From the four corners of Southern California, this is The Hot Seat, and you're in it with me, Max Schwartz. It starts right now. Today, on the phone from San Diego, I have the California State Assembly Majority Leader, Assemblywoman Toni Atkins. How are you, Assemblywoman Atkins? Thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy Monday schedule to call in today.
Great. Thank you, Max. I'm happy to be here.
My pleasure. And we're very happy to have you. I hope you are having a very nice and productive recess. Now, I have lots of important questions, so without further ado, let's get started. I want to first start off by talking about your position as Majority Leader. So, what is it like being the Majority Leader in a body that is more than two-thirds Democratic?
Well, one might think, Max, that it's relatively simple and that we're pushing ahead and doing all kinds of things that would support the Democratic Caucus ideals. But what I would suggest is that the range of Democrats within our caucus, and we have a supermajority, or we will have again. It's been a little bit movable over time because seats have been vacated, people have run for state senate, and so we've had to replace those seats. We have one coming up tomorrow, you might know.
Yeah.
So I would just say there's a range of opinions within the Democratic caucus as well. So it's not exactly as easy as some people might think, but I would say that it has made it somewhat easier to move things like the Affordable Care Act and a number of areas of legislation that we care about, restoring some services to poor kids in our state. So it's certainly a good place to be, but it's not, I think, as simple as some people might think.
And I'm sort of happy you mentioned that because that's going to be a part of our conversation later, mm-hmm. especially about the governor. But before we get into that, I want to stay on the caucus. And for those that do not know, what does your job entail and how do you have time to be Majority Leader and Legislator?
Well, thank you. Majority Leader basically is the position that manages the flow of legislation on the Assembly floor. You know, we see a couple of thousand bills a year from the Assembly side and from the Senate side. So my job is to work very closely with the Speaker and some designated other members, the Majority Whip, Assistant Floor Leader, to make sure that it flows smoothly. And I, in fact, also work with the Minority Floor Leader, Kurt Hagman, on the Republican side. So it really is about floor management, procedural votes, moving legislation through in an orderly fashion. And it does take up quite a bit of time during the week as we plan for Assembly floor sessions on Monday and Thursday. So it is sort of the equivalent. I'm not a chair of any committee. This is what I do. This is my responsibility, and this is what I chair, basically.
So in terms of moving legislation through the floor, is that predominantly you or the Speaker, or is it both you of a combination of the two working together?
It's a combination of the two working together. He pretty much gives me wide latitude in order to run the floor. But we meet multiple times a week to make sure that we're in sync and that we know what's going on, if there are any surprises. So I work very closely with the Speaker. He is the leader of our caucus. Mm-hmm. We work together to make sure things run smoothly.
And how do you have time to do all of that, plus be with constituents and manage, and even though you have, I'm assuming, fantastic caseworkers in your district office, how do you do that, plus all of your constituent services?
Well, I do have great staff, I have to say, in the district and at the Capitol who understand that constituent services come first. And I think because I come out of local government as a former city council member and was acting mayor in San Diego at one point, I understand how important it is to connect with constituents. It means my schedule's incredibly busy. When we are in session, I'm in Sacramento Monday through Thursday late afternoon, and I'm home Thursday night through Monday morning. And so my Thursday nights, Fridays, Saturdays, and sometimes half of the day Sunday are incredibly busy going to community meetings. And that's why this legislative recess, as we call it, it's not a break, it's a recess from the Capitol, is so important. I'm at one meeting tonight, two community meetings tomorrow night, and I spend most of my time with constituents now.
So there is no negative impact. In fact, it would probably be a positive impact that you're in charge of what goes through the floor, or co-in charge.
Well, I see it as a very positive thing for my constituents. I know more about what's happening legislatively than most of the other members because I have a unique overview. Mm-hmm. I manage the process on the floor with the Speaker, of course, and with the pro tem who chairs the meeting. And so I have a unique position to actually have a broader view of what's going on. And, of course, I'm always thinking about San Diego County, the cities I represent here, and my constituents. It makes it it's actually not hard to keep in mind what you need to focus on, and it's better when you have a broader overview.
Okay, and I have a few more questions about the caucus, one of which is there was an influx of freshman members because of new districts or legislators being termed out. What was it like being with running a caucus with so many freshmen, and what did you do to act as a role model?
Well, it is a unique challenge, and it's a good one. I mean, to have a caucus with approximately 55 members, you know, it's changed from 52 to 55, but basically majority and a supermajority, you have, as I said earlier, you have a wealth and range of ideas and concerns. And so it was a little more challenging this year than I think it has been in past years for two reasons. One, a large influx of new members, and two, the term limit change. We are now, they came in under 12-year term limits, whereas my class and the class ahead of me, the speaker's class, we're under 6-year term limits. So it's created a little bit of a dynamic. I would say that many of us who've been there for two, three, four years, are really working closely with the freshman class, but many of them have also served locally, so they don't come to the state with no informed information about how it works and what to do. So it's been a little bit more lively, a lot busier in terms of relationship building, but there's been less legislation coming forward, and I think that's because the new members realize they have longer to craft and create legislation, and they are seemingly way more thoughtful about it.
And I think also it has to do with them learning the ropes. And I want to go back to the question, how do you act as a role model to teach them the ways of the Capitol?
Mm-hmm. Well, that happens because, you know, we have committee chairs and we have leadership positions, and a number of the new members are part of the speaker's leadership team, and they sit with members who've been there 2 to 4 years, and we work together. I have quite a few new members. I would say Chris Holden is my assistant majority leader. He's from Los Angeles. Jimmy Gomez is the majority whip. He is from, or assistant majority whip. He's from L.A. as well. Kevin Mullen is the assistant pro tem. So we mentor them as we do our jobs. And, of course, you know, as you discuss legislation, some of it can be controversial. You form relationships. And, you know, we do give guidance in caucus about the role of the chair, about the role of caucus members, how you, when you disagree with a member of your caucus on a bill, the appropriate ways to talk to your fellow colleagues, and yet at the same time get your concerns out and express it. So we have had orientation for new members. I went through orientation. They've gone through orientation. And then you form relationships. And there are so many new members. I mean, I walk every many mornings with Sharon Quirk Silva from Orange County. So, you know, you find informal and formal ways to work together. And a number of the new members really seek out and ask questions. They're very thoughtful. So it sort of is we're a captive audience in Sacramento, so we spend a lot of time together.
Okay, that's very good to know. And now I'd like to get into the issues. And one thing I'd like to talk about is something that's actually not legislation that made the front page of the LA Times this weekend, yesterday morning, and it was in the LA Times again today. And that is about the missing toxic chemicals or the missing toxic waste. And there, basically, the article was about how there's toxic waste misting from generator to disposal site, and how part of the problem is that the system is so archaic. That's my term. So I don't know if you happen to see the LA Times, but
I did.
So how worried were you when you saw that piece run? And what are you going to try to do to...
You know, concerns, these are how things, concerns are sometimes brought to legislators' attention. We have an issue on residential care facilities in San Diego County that's brought to the forefront some issues that legislators are going to be looking at. This is the very similar situation. When you see things of this nature that come forward through the media, and I think we have to be thankful that there is investigative reporting and the ability to learn this stuff, because what it does is it highlights what we need to do. We're legislators. Our primary job is to approve a budget, make sure that we have a budget in place for our state. Secondarily, to look at legislation, what could be good for our state. And third, it's to monitor legislation being implemented. We have the ability to do oversight hearings. So given what we just saw in the LA Times, as that broke over the weekend, I think you're going to find that chairs of the toxics committee and others are going to start to ask questions of the administration, of the governor and the administration, so that we start to look more in depth at this issue. And so I foresee that's probably what will happen. And, you know, we'll get into it.
Did you know the problem was that bad?
No, I did not.
Okay. And would you say, or would you believe that someone in your caucus or you would try to pass legislation to either fix this problem or do something to make, I guess, the department more technologically advanced?
I foresee that would be absolutely the case. I mean, you know, there is a chair of a committee that oversees these kinds of issues. Will probably be very active and engaged in getting information immediately based on these articles. Sometimes we're ahead of the news that comes out in terms of oversight and review, and sometimes we find out from the media. So I have no doubt that there will be some research and questions asked and hearings even possibly. I don't doubt it for a minute.
In your mind, is there any excuse as to why this happened or why they're so technologically behind the times?
Well, California is a huge state. We have 38 million residents. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about, I mean, you know, I know you're going to get into the Affordable Health Care Act and the websites. When you look at, and I represent the city of San Diego. I sat on the city council. We upgraded our technology when I was on the council. And it always seems to be the case that when you're trying to upgrade your technology and your systems and that it will cost more money than you anticipated and that it will take longer and there will be issues that come up that you didn't anticipate. I am not a I'm not a high-tech person or a technology. I would not say is my strong suit, but I would say that I have learned over my time in public office that these are the most difficult things to roll out and have them go as you plan because, and I think the biggest piece is because we are so large.
Yeah.
We're still trying to connect our court system computer database so that if you are arrested in Redding, California, and you have a long record in San Diego and a court history, we are still trying to integrate those systems to make sure that we are in current day technology and capability to share that information. So I'm not surprised to hear it. I do think it takes a commitment of resources. And when you have budget deficits, as we've had in the last couple of years before this past year, this budget year that we're in, you tend to look at things like technology as being probably not the most critical thing on the chopping block when you're having to pass a budget. So those tend to be the things that get pushed aside. Should it be the case? No. But we're going to have to pick it up, and we're going to have to figure out how to deal with this.
I agree that technology improvements aren't necessarily a top priority when in red, but...
Right.
But given that there could have been more oversight regardless of technology, I think that's a big issue here. And one more question. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but are you disappointed with the way the governor has handled that department?
Well, I have to say I would need more information. I'm the kind of person that wants to hear, and I think hearings will bring out more information. I think if you look at the governor's plate, he's got quite a bit on it, from prisons, which I know you have questions about.
Yeah.
A number of other issues. So, you know, that's why he counts on department heads, and I'm sure he has questions of his own staff. So, you know, having actually run large departments and things like that and had to oversee them at the city, I'm not going to be the first to throw stones, but I am going to say we've got to deal with it, we've got to address it, and we've got to make sure that our environment, our communities are protected. This is a critical issue. And so I have a feeling that our governor has some very strong questions of his own staff, who he expects to run the departments. And I have no doubt that he is doing as much investigative work right now as he can because it's at the forefront.
Okay. And I have another subject that was in the LA Times, too, on Sunday. And I can understand if you don't want to talk about Senator Calderon directly, but there was a whole article about the use of nonprofits in the Capitol. Do you have a specific stance on legislators setting up nonprofits?
You know, I'm not sure why we would do that. I, you know, I, It's not something I've looked into personally for myself or am quite aware of. That aside from campaign funds, which you raise in order to get reelected.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not as knowledgeable on it. Do I think it's necessary? I'm not sure that it is. I can work with any nonprofit I would like to support and help their efforts. And when you do that, there are disclosure laws that you follow. If I raise money for a nonprofit in my community, there is the Fair Political Practices Commission expects you to fill out a behest form.
Mm-hmm.
If I raise $5,000 for the local Boys and Girls Club, I am required to disclose that and submit a form to the FPPC. And it's a system that you need to track and monitor and do. So it doesn't mean you can't have a relationship with nonprofits. Many of these organizations are great organizations that you're trying to do good works. Now, there may be questionable organizations, and you should be able to figure that stuff out, but disclosure and transparency is the key.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that, and given that there is current legal action pending, I'm not going to ask you any questions specific to Senator Calderon, and I'm not sure what you have been instructed to do by your aides and the Assembly's aides. So I'd like to now shift to talking about the governor. You mentioned him earlier. Are you or the caucus disappointed in the way he has handled some of the bills put before him in terms of either being not liberal enough or being too liberal?
Well, I would say personally, of course, you're going to find members who are disappointed. I'm disappointed that Governor Brown didn't support my inclusionary housing bill, 1229.
Mm-hmm.
I think other members are going to be disappointed about various pieces of legislation. As a whole, I think that, to be honest, I think the governor has done a good job of balancing issues based on the fact that he has a very diverse group of Democrats in the caucuses in both the Senate and the Assembly. So I think, and he has to represent Californians. And I think the governor's history is one that shows that he really likes to tackle each issue, likes to weigh the pros and cons and make a decision. I think if we're disappointed in terms of in mass, groups of legislators who might be disappointed about this, that, or the other, there might be some disappointment on some of the gun legislation. There's probably some disappointment that we have not been able to find a mechanism to deal with the demise and death of redevelopment agencies in the state that we did 3 years ago, and the courts ruled, and we weren't able to have a similar program in place. And I think many of the members, both in the Senate and the Assembly, care about economic development and tools and mechanisms to create it. So health care, I think largely we are pretty satisfied in terms of how we're moving forward despite some of the problems, and I think the governor has been pretty good on that. So overall, I would say that, it's an interesting relationship. There's always going to be tension between legislators and governors, and it's there whether the governor is of an opposite party or the same party. It's just a little different in terms of the dynamics. And so I think you're going to find some legislators are disappointed, and I think you're going to find some who feel pretty good. And mostly I think it's just sort of a neutral area in which we appreciate some of the things and would like a little more activity in other things.
Absolutely. And I will say that I will bring up the LA Times poll that ran, I think it was last week, if not the week before, the USC Dornsife LA Times poll, which said a majority of Americans support Governor Brown. However, only 32% would elect him for another term. And I'm glad you brought up the gun legislation, because that's one area in particular he was definitely not as liberal as he could have been.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I think, what's interesting is California, fortunately, I supported all of the gun legislation that moved through the Assembly and made it to the floor. I think California, we acknowledge that has some of the toughest gun laws and regulations in the country. But in the face of great tragedies, I think there are legislators, much like communities, who feel somewhat helpless and feel like we need to do more. We need to do more. And so I think you're going to find that there's some disappointment on the issue of his balanced approach. I think that's what I heard it referred to as. But I will tell you, the gun lobby doesn't really see it that way. They see it as major losses. And the people who support gun legislation, like myself and some of my colleagues, see it as not quite a full win because we had a tragedy occur a couple weeks ago at the airport.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you legislate every single action, but I think that it's going to continue to be an issue, which I think is what you're interested also in hearing. Do we think there will be more legislation this year? Yes, I do. We have a member in Oakland who's had serious issues and has brought forward a number of pieces of legislation, as well as an assembly member in L.A. So I think you're going to see more gun legislation.
And I believe you're talking about Assemblywoman Nancy Skinner, who had an interesting idea to regulate the bullets, because ultimately that's what kills people, not the gun itself. But about the airport, do you believe that there will be calls though for greater regulation in airports or around airports, or to do something to have the TSA protected?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what comes out of people's analysis of where we can make it stronger. I mean, what happens anytime a tragedy like that occurs is you have lots of great minds, whether federally or at the state levels, looking to see what's currently allowed, where are the gaps. And so I bet right now you've got a number of folks busy looking at where the gaps are and what we can do to make it safer and stronger. I mean, you know, we've just focused so heavily on security at airports that it sort of astounds someone that something like that could happen. But I guarantee there's a lot of evaluation going on about how we can strengthen security at the airports and places, you know, public places like that.
Absolutely. And speaking of, I want to talk about, one more question on this issue personally. Were you upset because Governor Brown vetoed a bill that would have prevented, that would have, I guess, tightened restrictions on people that have been charged with prior gun crimes and drug offenses? Are you upset that he vetoed a bill that would have tightened, gun laws on for those specific individuals? Because that seems something that could be more or less common sense.
Well, you know, that's an easy statement. I've learned in elected politics and public service that nothing is as seemingly common sense as you or I might think.
Mm-hmm.
Disappointed, yes, I am. But I think that the art of politics and what I do every day is continuing to chip away at arguments for and against something and trying to refine your discussion and your dialogue and make the point to people. And obviously we need to do more work with our colleagues and with the governor. And that's what the process is about. That's why, you know, some people think it's really easy to pass a bill and legislation. It is so difficult because you have to counter all kinds of arguments in support and in opposition, and there are groups that you would never imagine that even exist that show up in support or opposition. And, you know, all that does is forge the groundwork and the environment for more discussion. So I was personally disappointed, yes. But I think that it is not—it's not a done issue. It's not finished. That it will continue to be a discussion, and I have no doubt that it will come back.
I agree with that, and I think it's arguable that part of the reason he vetoed that bill is to avoid a lawsuit from the NRA, which they said they would have considered. And I'd like to move on now to another bill, Governor Brown vetoed, which was SB 1434, which would have required law enforcement agencies to get search warrants before searching GPS information from electronic devices. So two questions on that. Where do you stand on the governor's veto of that bill, and where do you stand on the NSA revelations as a whole?
Well, I have to say it's disconcerting to hear how much is being allowed at the federal level. I mean, as any American would be, you know, this is a matter of privacy. And these get into the discussions we have in the legislature. Where is the line between respecting and protecting the right to privacy and ensuring the public safety for communities? I mean, let me just put two issues together. If law enforcement had been able to determine that this young man who killed the TSA worker, if they had been able to glean enough information through their sources, just listening, monitoring, would have justified stopping him before he was able to do the terrible act and kill and cause disruption at the airport. I think when you take that case and it's a specific example, people might say yes. I think if you take it with no person and no situation involved, the public is going to say, no, you can't do that. That's an invasion of privacy. And that is the fine line discussion that we continue to have. I am disconcerted to hear how invasive it has been, and I think that's why you have the federal hearings going on. And I think that's called for, and I think it's warranted. And I think for us at the state level, you know, there's a whole federal overlay that we have to be respectful of and let that process work, because then it's equitable across every state. At the local level and at the state level, you know, I think we have to look at these things very thoughtfully as well, and get into those discussions at the state level, and what is our jurisdiction to do, and what is our responsibility to do, and how we don't interfere with the federal level. And so that's what makes these discussions harder.
In terms of specifically the bill, though,
I err on the side of privacy for individuals.
Okay.
I think we have to err on the side of privacy for individuals.
So in terms of the actual bill, though, because he vetoed that, and given what you said on what you talked about, you just said about privacy, are you, or do you believe someone else will try to propose similar legislation to try to get the governor to sign it?
I do. You know, there's kind of a saying in Sacramento, no legislative idea is ever completely new, and no piece of legislation or idea is ever dead. And so I think in light of what's going on in the world around us, you're going to see a reaction and legislation continue to be discussed, you know, that takes into account everything we're learning day by day by day through investigations, hearings, and what the media comes out with. So I anticipate we'll have more discussion, yes.
Okay. And at the same time, the governor has been very liberal in other pieces of legislation, such as by allowing people who are in the country illegally to have driver's license. He expanded access to abortion and included domestic workers in overtime pay. So what, how happy are you that he did those things? And what do you think it says to you that California is leading that California is the first to do all this? And do you think this will start a national trend?
Well, I do think the governor's intention on the immigration issues was to send a message federally that the federal government is not progressing on this. We are not getting to resolution of some of the issues that are critical. And I think he even made statements to the fact that, yes, I think California should be on the cutting edge of trying to provide some direction, given how large our state is and the impact and the fact that it's a real issue for us on the immigration stuff. So I think he is sending a clear message. I think it can be something that moves other states and moves the agenda forward. On the abortion-related issues and reproductive rights, which was my bill, we are not the first state. There were four other states that expanded already. We were the only one this year, but there are four states that already allow nurse practitioners, certified nurse midwives, and PAs, physician's assistants, to do abortions. So we weren't first out of the gate on that, but I do think the timeliness of the governor supporting, continuing to support issues around reproductive rights for women really understates and underscores, adds an exclamation point, that California will continue to be on record in moving forward in those discussions and not backwards. And so I think there are ways, it's interesting, there are ways that we set the trend for the nation, and occasionally we're not the first to step forward. So
I assume you're happy about all, given what you just said, happy
I
about
am.
All these?
I'm personally very happy about all of his actions on these measures, yes.
Are you happy California took the first step in some of these issues?
Yes.
Okay.
I am.
And you brought it up a little bit earlier, but I'm going to talk about Covered California now. And last week, the California legislature received a report. So we are doing considerably better than the healthcare.gov federal website. However, it seems from at least an outsider looking in that Covered California has dropped to two or three behind Connect, and some would say New York's system, and Connect being Kentucky's. So how do you believe, or how is the exchange doing based off the report you received last week?
Well, I think we're pleased that we're certainly doing better than a number of other states. We've put a lot of work into this in terms of trying to be ready and move forward. I think that we certainly have still some questions to answer for people and some work to do. And in light of the president's stance, I think you know, we're going to have to continue to monitor this day by day. I think in terms of our insurance commissioner, Dave Jones, I think he is moving in tandem, certainly with the president. And our goal is to try to make this transition as smooth and seamless as we possibly can. And I think the extension seems to be a pragmatic result and response to trying to make sure that we get the transition correct. We've got work to do. You know, I think originally we thought it would be difficult. We thought it would be, you know, there would be things that would come up that we would have to address quickly. But we thought that would be statewide as opposed to some of the issues at the federal level playing out that are impacting us. But we're still optimistically moving forward. We've still got some questions we have to answer so that people understand what benefits they may actually be able to get, who their doctors will be, what hospitals. Those are the kinds of questions we're spending day-to-day working with Covered California to make sure we get the answers for our constituents.
And you said that there are federal issues affecting Covered California. Could you go a little bit into detail and explain what those issues are?
Well, if the president says we need to take another year, if we need to let people keep the current plan they're on for another year, that sort of, you know, we are implementing Covered California and moving forward. Mm-hmm. And so it does change a little bit the path that we were on to be up and rolling and moving forward by January 1st. If there is a national agreement to let people keep the plan they're on right now, I think the biggest issues here, it's very complex, but I think the biggest issues here are clearly there needs to be stronger efforts and a lot more education so people who are considering registering in the exchange for Covered California have the information they need to move forward and know that they're going to be covered, that they're going to get the kind of coverage they need. That's the education that needs to be done. And what people are missing in terms of people having to go off of their current insurance and that it may cost a little more or they're not quite sure, is that the level of benefit under Covered California and the expansion is a much higher level of service than what people were getting under their old plans.
Absolutely.
And so I think the big fear right now is to be without coverage or not know what you're going to do. Once the transition occurs and people realize what more they're going to get, I think they'll be happy, but this is going to continue to be something we focus on to make sure the transition starts to smooth out a little more.
Okay, and I have one more issue to discuss quickly before we run out of time, and that is the courts. It appears that Governor Brown has fought with practically every level of the federal judiciary to try to keep the state prison system population at the current level it is right now. Are you discouraged that he's picking the fight to try to keep prisons rather than the fight to try to change our incarceration system or how people are incarcerated or the length of time?
Well, I think in terms of the number of people we have in prisons right now and your comment that the governor's trying to keep it the same, I think the problem is because of AB 109 and realignment that we supported and did last session with the governor to move more prisoners to the local level, the problem is there are Californians who, on one hand, want different sentencing and want us to look at sentencing requirements, which we seriously need to do, and we need to get underway doing that immediately. And there was at least one piece of legislation that the governor vetoed that would have helped us start that process. So I'm disappointed in that because long-term, if we're really going to change the situation long-term, we have got to start now dealing with sentencing issues and requirements, and we've got to reverse the trend of putting so many people in prison when, in fact, the kinds of crimes they commit may be crimes where they need services, rehabilitative services, you know, as opposed to being put in prison. We've got to start that. But you've got to do both at the same time. Were he to try to reduce the prison population as much as the courts want him to do right now, we would be putting people on the streets, out of prison, and the California citizens would not be happy with that. Mm-hmm. And I hear from them every day. Because what we've already done has moved the nonviolent, non-serious, non-sexual crimes to the local level. What you've got now still in prison could be cases where serious crimes. And I think that you're going to get pushback from citizens and communities on that issue. So what we need to do is short-term, what he is trying to do is to work with the courts to buy time. But we got to present to the courts a realistic plan for how we're going to reduce the population. And that's where we have been weak in California. We have got to come up with a viable short-term, moving into long-term plan to move the prison population, reduce sentencing levels for non-serious crimes, and to figure out how to work with local governments on the populations that they now have in their local jails. And the problem is, you got to do it all at once. And at the moment, the courts would like us, you know, since 2006, we have released or moved 40,000 people out of state prisons.
Yeah.
So, again, another complicated issue. I think we need to be started on the sentencing commission and guidelines for changing that if we're really going to affect it long term. In the short term, we really do need to be working with the courts to figure out what they will allow us to do, how we can safely keep prisoners in place and yet make sure that they're going to be, that the prisons are not overcrowded.
Yes, and it seems as though, at least from an outsider looking in, that Governor Brown is looking at the problem and not looking at how to fix the source of the problem. At least that's my personal perspective.
Well, you know, when you're in charge and you have a critical situation and you're under threat of a federal court mandate, you got to fix the current problem as quickly as you can. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he has been working with the legislature, both the Senate and the Assembly, to try to figure out how to put together a short-term plan. Now, of course, you know that the Senate and the Assembly don't necessarily agree with what the short-term plan could be,
yeah.
And that makes it a little harder. So I have to tell you, I'm more than impressed with your depth of knowledge on all these issues and that you're making time to take this and put it on the air, because I think these are really important issues in our state, and you have quite a wonderful grasp of how complex all these things are.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the compliment. And one more question, and it's a quick one. What do you plan to do when you're termed out in 2016?
Wow. Well, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I didn't intend to run for the state assembly and decided to do that. So I'm going to let each day take its course. And in the meantime, I've got no lack of issues and work to do. So
it certainly sounds like it. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join me, Majority Leader Atkins. It was a pleasure having you on, and we hope to have you on again in the near future once the assembly gets back in session. I really do appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today.
Thank you, Max.
My pleasure. The Hot Seat After Hours starts right now. You can email me at thehotseatwithmaxschwartz@gmail.com, or you can tweet me at MaxSchwartzTV. You can also read and follow my blog at www.maxschwartztv.blogspot.com. Thank you for listening. The Hot Seat will be off next week because of the Thanksgiving holiday, but we hope to have you back next time. Have a great rest of the week.